We will pick up this evening in Genesis 25 and finish up this lesson on Isaac and Rebekah. We got down to question 7 in lesson 8, and that's where we left off on Sunday. How old was Abraham when he died? 175, yeah. He'd been in the land how long? Yeah, 100 years. Excuse me. In the context of Genesis, it's a relatively short life, isn't it? The lifespans are going down as we go along. But yet here in his description, beginning in verse 7 of chapter 25 there, or in verse 8 rather, Abraham breathed his last and died at a ripe old age, an old man and satisfied with life. First time we've seen that description in the book. And he was gathered to his people. What's significant about gathered to his people there? Anyone see any significance there? Yes, absolutely. And gathered with those people where? In the grave?
Abraham's bosom.
Yeah, yeah.
So Abraham's on bosom.
Yeah, exactly. Good way to put it. So, yeah, an indication of life after death. I think it's absolutely obvious there. As he's buried with Sarah, she would hardly be called gathered to his people there in the cave of Machpelah. So I think definitely in good company, as Brad would say, and a proof of life after death. Kiel would state, one comment he had, this denotes a reunion in Sheol, the grave, with friends who have gone on before, and therefore supposes faith in a personal continuance of a man. So 70 years after Ishmael was driven away from the family, we see him appear again here as he and Isaac bury their father. It's just one of those things you wonder what went on in that 70-year period as he was driven away. Was there contact? Did Isaac make contact again later? Did they bury the hatchet, so to speak, and get together to bury their father? That wouldn't be the only time that's ever happened where siblings reunited at the death of a parent. It's just one of those things we'll always have to wonder about. Nothing else is said about Ishmael, but he appears on the scene there. So just a note on the chronology from the Waldron book. I always appreciate those. It helps me stay grounded in as we see these characters and kind of associate their ages and learn more about them. Abraham was at 100, was 100 at the birth of Isaac, of course, in chapter 21. Isaac was 40 when he married Rebekah, and Isaac was 60, we'll learn later in the chapter, at the birth of his sons. So therefore, Abraham would have been 160 when the twins were born, and therefore they would have been 15. Jacob and Esau would have been 15 at the time of Abraham's death. Some of those things you don't think much about, but they would have definitely known their grandfather and had some association with him there. So we've been studying Abraham for several weeks, and he's held up in Scripture as one of the most influential characters. The Jews, of course, would think so. So I just wanted to mention a few lessons that we've discussed here. And while I'm doing that, be thinking, I want to hear lessons you see from the life of Abraham that we can take as we make the connections that we're looking for this quarter. So, and I am woefully behind. All right, lessons from Abraham. Obedience may take us far from our comfort zone. Think about leaving the land of your home, God telling him to go and go to a place where I will show you, not knowing where he was going, but having the trust in God to make that journey. Sometimes it may demand hard things and difficult decisions. Think of all those times Abraham was asked to do something difficult during his life, and yet he trusted God fully and the promises he had made to him. God will give us what we need to grow and mature in our faith. We talked about it a couple of times. Abraham, maybe not exactly where he ended up with his faith, but God allowing him the time to grow and become what he needed to be. We all will go through that struggle, and God will certainly help us go through that and come out successful on the other side. God's faithfulness to all his promises. We've seen that throughout. Think about the protection that was offered to Abraham throughout his sojourn in the land of Canaan. God's faithfulness to the righteous as he questioned God, would you destroy the righteous of Sodom if I could find X amount of people? And God allowed him to work through that and would have been faithful to that promise had he been able to find the 10 that he settled on. Think about Isaac's birth, the promise thereof, and how we talked about even when Isaac or Abraham was unfaithful and lied about Sarah being his sister, God kept her pure during that time, preserving the promise and the surety of that promise that Isaac would indeed be born of Abraham and Sarah. And then, of course, the picture of a righteous man that we see. Paul would hold up Abraham and his behavior, his obedience as righteous, and we've talked about that several times. So if we learn nothing else from the book, I think that's a picture we need to see as we consider Abraham. So what lessons do you see? I know you have some. I'm anxious to hear them. Yeah, if you graph that, there's not going to be huge swings one way or the other. It's going to be pretty consistent. There may be ebbs and flows, little slight dips, slight highs, slight lows, but it very much a picture of consistent. What else? Yeah, think of the words to Esther. Who knows whether or not you were put here was the one through whom God made that promise, but it. What else? Yeah, Mike. And that doesn't mean that we don't have questions. Abraham had questions during that and certainly wondered how he was going to accomplish that, but the patience won out for sure. Anyone else? Yeah, and that would be the comment of both of those kings to him is like, look at the position you've put us in because of what you did. And of course, the sordid mess with Hagar and with Sarah in trying to help God along. Did I see another hand somewhere? Trevor? Yeah, that reminds me, as you said that, of the time after he made the decision that he was going to destroy the earth. We talked about that one. During that 120 years, it was all about trying to save souls, was wearing or bearing with man. Anyone else? Tony? Yeah, good point. And God saw that and blessed him. All right, so we will move on then from Abraham. As we've seen the pattern in Genesis, the narrator will cite the brief lineages of the lesser important characters to the narrative and then move on. We see that here again, first the beginning of the chapter with Keturah and her sons. Then here in verse 12, it moves on to the generations of Ishmael. And goes through those for a few verses down to verse 18. And then, of course, beginning in verse 19, we move to that next major section, the generations of Isaac. So we've moved from the generations of Terah back in chapter 11 to the generations now of Isaac as we move forward. So first, looking at that section of Ishmael, the promises that were made to both Hagar and to Abraham as his parents, indeed born out here, and I think Moses highlights those in the narrative, or in the genealogy here. He talks about these are the names of the sons of Ishmael by their names. He goes through those. And then down in verse 16, the 12 princes according to their tribes. Of course, Ishmael's end at 137 years. He breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. And then it says they settled from the Havilah to Shur, which is east of Egypt, as one goes toward Assyria. And then one of those places where there's a little bit of discrepancy based on which version you look at. Here in the New American Standard, it says he settled in defiance of all his relatives. Does anyone have the New King James handy? There in verse 18. Yeah, died in the presence of, where the rest of the versions, the Holman Christian Standard says he lived in opposition to his brothers. The NIV lived in hostility toward. The ESV would translate it almost an exact quote of the way it translates 16:12 and that promise to Hagar, as says he lived over against all his kinsmen. I think the idea borne out here is a fulfillment of that prophecy of 1612 where it talks about him, misquote it, in 16, when he makes that promise to Hagar in verse 12, he says, he will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone and everyone's hand will be against him. And he will live, here in the New American Standard says, he will live to the east of all his brothers. So of course that's borne out. But I think the idea there in that verse in 25 is most likely a fulfillment of that prophecy, and those other translations being the more accurate one, is my opinion. All right, so then we move into the generations of Isaac. Abraham's son, it says. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean, to be his wife. So about 20 years pass in that 20 and 21. Verses 20 and 21 there, it says, Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. So much like Sarah, his mother, not able to have children, and Isaac prayed on her behalf. And of course, God remembered her. God answered. She was then pregnant with the twins. So what prophecy does the Lord make concerning the twins? Rebekah inquires there in verse, what verse is it? Yeah, verse 22, the children struggled together within her, and she said, if it is so, why then am I this way? Kind of a hard translation there to make. I think the sense is, you know, God has remembered me. If everything is okay, then why this struggle? It must have been extraordinary, more so than most pregnancies. Anyone who's been associated with childbirth knows that there's always kicking and movement, but this must have been something out of the ordinary. So she went to inquire of the Lord, it says, and then what does the Lord tell her? What does he prophesy? Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the idea. That translation is all over the place. If you look at a bunch of different versions, you'll get lots of different ways that's translated. And I think that, so yeah, two nations. We'll look more as we go into the next few chapters of that struggle between them in life. But, God's point at this point with the two nations, what does Paul pull from that? Trevor mentioned Romans 9. What's the point that Paul uses from this story there in Romans 9? Yeah, there in Romans chapter 9, beginning verse 10. And not only this, but there was Rebekah also, when she had conceived twins by one man, our father Isaac. For through the twins were not yet born and had not done anything good or bad, so that God's purpose according to his choice would stand, not because of works, but because of him who calls. And it was said to her, the older will serve the younger, just as it is written. Of course, taken from Malachi, Jacob I have loved, Esau I have hated. So what's his point in that particular passage? Was it personal? To a degree, maybe? Let me go at it another way. How does the world run with that verse? What do they take? What do they pull from Romans? Yeah, that's what I meant. So, yeah, Paul's making the point, this was about nations. God chose through the seed of Isaac of Jacob, the people, the nation through whom he would bless not just a few people, but the entire world. I mean, that's the point that's being made there, and we need to be careful as we see that story and pull from it exactly what was intended to be seen. It's a foreshadowing of God's divine election, yes, but for his purposes in blessing the whole world, not a personal decision. Does that make sense? Did I butcher that sufficiently? Marshall, clean it up for me. Moses would make that point pretty specifically to them. It's not because of anything you've done. It's not because you were greater than any other nation around. It was because of God's choice. Same thing Paul says here. It's before the children had done anything good or bad, God made that decision through whom he would bless the world. Yeah. Yeah, so much of God's purpose would not be clearly seen until, of course, the New Testament and the New Covenant. Any other comments there before we move on? Yeah, this section of Romans 9 is all from that section where they were saying, like, what did it all mean? What was it for? All right, so we move on then. Let me get back over to Genesis. It won't help if I read from... So when her days, there in verse 24, when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. The first came forth red, all over like a hairy garment. His name him Esau. That name Esau, Edom, red will be a repeated theme throughout. We've got, you know, the red hair, the red child. Edom was a red land, red rocks. You got the red stew that we'll look at in the next account. So very much all of that working together there in that name, Esau. Afterward, his brother came forth with his hand holding onto Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob, or heel grabber, supplanter, another word that will be used of him. And Isaac, of course, 60 years old when she gave birth to them. So then it goes on to talk about their characteristics. When the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field, very much an outdoorsman. Jacob, more of a peaceful, domesticated sort, living in tents. Some descriptions of him maybe more concerned with, as we'll see through the story, the concerns of the family than Esau would have been, of course, as will be borne out. And then in verse 28, now Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Oh, that comment there about Isaac loving Esau because he loved the taste of the game is kind of a shallow picture to me. Anyone have any comment there? That's one. I didn't go chasing that one too far, but it just always puzzled me that what's the old adage about a way to a man's heart's through his stomach? Kind of the idea there. So yeah, very sensual, physical type thing, looking for that satisfaction. Yep. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the minor lessons. I don't know if it's the point of the... I mean, we're told that for a reason. So obviously it's a part of the story going forward. And it is certainly a minor lesson that we can learn, maybe a major lesson we can learn from the whole account of this family. All right, so quickly we'll have time probably to get through just through this next account. The story of Isaac, or Esau rather, being out on a hunt. He comes in, he's famished, looking for food. Jacob is cooking, and he wants some of that. So he makes the bargain, of course, for the birthright. We all know the story. He finishes up the account there in the last verse, verse 34. He gave him the bread, the lentil stew. He ate and drank, rose and went on his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. So I ask the question, how did Esau despise his birthright? Well, that sums it up pretty well, doesn't it? He willingly gave it up for food. Doug? Yeah, yeah. That's very possible. That particular food was what he wanted at that time. Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry? Yes, exactly. Yeah. Wenham would describe it as a careless indifference to a privilege that the ancient world held so dear. The Waldrons refer to him as profane. Of course, we know that word. That's taking the translation from the New King James in Hebrews 12, describing Esau willing to trade the birthright for some of that red stuff there, as the literal says. Someone pointed out, one of the commentators, and I don't know that it's the case, but maybe he had made that comment previously. Maybe he had shown some disdain or lack of regard for the birthright or for that responsibility that would fall to him. And Jacob had overheard that, causing Jacob to spend some time thinking about it. Jacob obviously was something he desired and had spent some time thinking about it because he had it so readily on his mind there in this situation. But whatever the history of that, Jacob made an offer to which Esau replied, "Behold, I am about to die." Kind of an indication of Esau's character there in the exaggeration. I think that was a little bit over the top. He, as Doug said, there would have been other food. Surely this big, strong hunter of the field could have survived long enough to go make himself something to eat. So he certainly wasn't about to die. One indication there in verse 34, Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and he drank and he rose and went on his way. What a recovery from a near-death experience. So, obviously, he was not in the situation he said he was. Kidner, I like the way Kidner described it. If Jacob is ruthless here, Esau is feckless. It says the versions, the different translations have toned down his spluttering, he calls it. The actual Hebrew there, translated more literally, says, let me gulp some of that red stuff, this red stuff. Embracing the present and the tangible at any cost. Going through with the choice and then walking away. Unconcerned. Incidentally, far from dead. So, yeah, this profane person, the blame would be totally laid at his feet there in verse 34. And then again in Hebrews chapter 12. We'll look at Hebrews chapter 12 on Sunday. Excuse me, a little bit later. But the idea there is him being profane in his treatment of the birthright. All right, so the indication from this passage is that this brief encounter, we're only given a few verses here, but it is a manifestation of his heart, of his attitude, of his mindset. His concerns were only temporal and carnal, looking to satisfy the now, the physical gratification, the here and now. What one further indication of that, we'll go on down to question 12 and pick it up here while we're dealing with Esau. What further details are given at the end of the chapter that lend a bit of insight into his character and his behavior? Yeah, so he saw no further than his own personal gratification at the age of 40. He weds those Hittite women, a grief to his parents, it says. Further indication of his inability to restrain himself and control himself. Christy reminded me of another good lesson, a connection that we could make here. Of course, any of you who are parents, you know the sleeplessness that goes along with young men and women and worrying about their future, the mates they choose. So certainly that is nothing new. That is an age-old problem, as it gave Isaac and Rebecca grief in his behavior. All right, that's probably as far as we'll get tonight. What comments on Esau before we go ahead, Jim? Definitely. Feckless would be a good description of next time. All right, thank you for your comments and your attention. We'll pick up there and get as far as we can in lesson 9 on Sunday.